Attention all passengers. The Uber ride for Mark and Jamal's romantic weekend will depart in 4 minutes from Platform 6. Your ride comes with a rolling countryside sunset view and a table seat ideal for playing footsie beneath. Thank you for booking your tickets on Uber.
Trains on Uber.
Summer. The kids are home, and after a long hot day, you just want to relax with the show that everyone's talking about. So flex your EE TV to include Netflix. Cool down with chilling thrillers like I Will Find You, or laugh along with brand new comedies including The Hawk. Because when you flex your EE TV to include Netflix, you can watch your way and catch all the summer hits. It's TV with the ultimate flex.
EE TV requires EE broadband. 24-month contracts. Content may vary. Terms apply.
Hello, I am Sadia Khan, and welcome back to Immigrantly. Two weeks ago, a 32-year-old Afro-Latina organizer from Harlem did something the entire Democratic establishment said was impossible. She beat a five-term congressman. No corporate money, no party machine, just doors knocked and a district that was done waiting. Her name is Daria Lisa Avila Chevalier, Democratic nominee, New York's 13th Congressional District. If November goes her way, she'll be the first Dominican woman ever elected to Congress. She's also Muslim. Also the daughter of immigrants, someone who has spent years in the streets, in the courts, and in the archives, fighting for the people this country was never built to protect. I've been waiting to have this conversation. So without further ado, let's jump right in. Daria Lisa, welcome. I'm a bit starstruck. Can I say that?
I just feel like a normal person.
I have been watching your race, following it. I am so impressed with how you've carried yourself. And we'll talk about all of those things, right? The politics, the scrutiny, the Democratic establishment meltdown. But I want to start somewhere else. You did something unprecedented. First Dominican woman on the path to Congress. And you did it while being picked apart in public. When you let yourself actually feel it, the wind, not the noise, where is it in your body? Describe it for me.
It's like in my chest. You know, it's really funny because I haven't had much time or like space to fully process it all, and it still all feels very surreal. Like I still wake up and I'm like, oh, that happened. Like, that's crazy. But when I think about, you know, the magnitude of what we just did, and it wasn't just me, it was a whole team of folks, incredible volunteers, my staff, people who really have a beautiful vision of what we can have in this country and in this world, who came together and shared that vision and built something bigger than all of us. And when I pause to think about it, you know, it just like fills in my chest, right? And it's like I stop breathing for a second. And it's like a lot to process that.
You said it still feels surreal. Mm-hmm. What part is surreal to you?
All of it, right? I think for so many of us, these institutions, these systems of power, they feel really out of reach. They feel larger than life, untouchable. And, you know, as someone who grew up feeling that it was something completely out of the realm of what was possible, right? Being the daughter of immigrants, being, you know, the daughter of working class people, right, who were struggling to make ends meet, to know that we've made history in the way that we have, to me, it hasn't fully sunk in, right? That is something that we accomplished. And I think that has to do with the fact that for so many, like, this is just something that you're told will never happen. But we did it. We did it. And that is like such an exciting feeling. And it's a very surreal and humbling feeling, particularly when I think about, you know, the number of people who came out and supported us.
So when you think about this feeling, do you ever struggle with imposter syndrome, or are you confident in what you've achieved?
You know, I think about it in a different sense. Like, I've never seen this as being about me. I've seen it more as being about building out movement work, right? And building out people power and knowing, you know, this is just my role now as an organizer. And so it's a different role from the one that I was in when I was doing more behind the scenes, when I was, you know, bringing people together for actions or whatever the task at hand was, right? But it's one where I'm very cognizant of the fact that it is just a role in this larger movement of building people power. It's not lost on me, the responsibility of that role. It's not lost on me that people are putting a great deal of trust in me. And I'm deeply honored to have won the trust of so many in that way.
Yeah, I was going to say that. You're being too generous and too humble. As women, I think sometimes we don't give ourselves enough credit. And sure, there's a huge team. Yeah. And, you know, congratulations to all. But Daria, Lisa, this is your moment as well, right? Just celebrating that, as you said, in your chest and feeling, yes, the burden of what's to come and the responsibility that you hold, but also just enjoying this moment and having fun with it. That's so important as well, right?
Yeah.
So going back to your childhood, now you grew up in Florida. Mm-hmm. I know you came to New York almost 14 years ago, so you're basically a New Yorker. But you grew up in Florida, a very different place. Mm-hmm. And you also traveled to Dominican Republic. I think when you were a child, you stayed there for a little bit. Mm-hmm. But then your parents came back. You were born in Florida. What has growing up or interacting with all these different communities taught you about yourself and how to basically code switch at times?
I think there's so much that you navigate as the child of immigrants, right? There's a little of here, a little of there, and you're always trying to bridge multiple worlds. It's not just two. I think a lot of people say you're bridging your parents' home country and your country here. And I think it's also the reality of this country is that there are so many versions of it, right? Depending on where you live, who you're interacting with, and always bridging those various versions of this country. You know, growing up, moved around a lot throughout Florida, but also my mom's family was here. So I was coming up to New York as well and visiting family in the Dominican Republic. Like, there was just always a bridge that we were crossing, right, in order to feel that we were home. In Florida, it was a very fascinating experience to be able to see so many facets of American reality and experience, right? And I think part of it was, for example, in Miami, you have a lot of Latinos. For many, you don't even have to really learn English to get around. And it's like very Spanish-speaking, very like Latino. And then you have like these communities in what's basically the Deep South, right? Where I spent a lot of time in Tallahassee and thinking about like, well, what does it mean to also be a Black woman in this country, right? And yes, I'm Latina, but I'm also Black. And like, how do you navigate these systems in a country that seems to try to box us all, right? Into these very finite and very just sanitized systems, right? No one fits into these types of boxes like that. And I think I just learned that there are just so many different versions of this country, right? And in that upbringing. And I just had such a beautiful upbringing in that way because of that, being able to meet so many people who have such different experiences and histories in this country, whether they're, you know, immigrant background, whether they're Black Americans, have been here for generations, the descendants of slaves. I think all of that is part of the fabric of resistance and resilience in this country that make me very proud to be part of that history.
So outside the external environment, outside communities, what was home like? Were your parents political? Was there more focus on something else? What was home like?
My mom and I were moving a lot. We were constantly moving because it was just like the rent would get raised, right? Or, you know, she would get a new job and she needed to be closer to it. Or there were just a number of circumstances growing up where it just felt like we had to pack up, go to a new place. And, you know, I think that shaped a lot of our understanding of what politics were, because you don't have time to sit down and watch C-SPAN. The reality is that, like, you know, you're a working class mom who has to raise a kid. Politics is like what's done to you. You hear what the politicians are saying and you're like, well, what about me? What about people like me, right? But you don't feel yourself included in those conversations. And I know my mom, for her, she actually became a citizen when she realized she couldn't vote for Obama. And so she was like, I wanted to vote for the first Black president in this country. And she couldn't. And so that's what pushed her to actually start becoming a citizen and to finally, like, naturalize after many years of living here.
Was there a reason she did not try to become a citizen before that?
I think she was like, this is fine. This is good enough, right? I have all the rights that everybody around me seems to have. And then she, like, realized, oh, I don't have a say in my politics. And I can't vote for this person who she felt was really going to bring about change, particularly for people who, you know, were working class, people of color, people, immigrant communities. And so she really wanted to be part of that. And realizing that she was not allowed to be was what pushed her. And she was one of the last few members of our family who still hadn't naturalized. And so that was the experience, I think, for her that, like, was really eye-opening of, like, this is why this is important.
When Obama became president, I was on my green card, so I couldn't vote for him. But I was so excited to see how America came together. It was one moment where I feel like everybody thought that the country had really come together. That was one watershed moment for a lot of people, including myself. I was so in awe of him and his messaging at the time.
Yeah, and I think for her, what she was feeling was, you know, this energy that people were coming together, that there was a moment where people's power was actually building. And I think what we're seeing now is, I had people last year when I was canvassing for the mayor, for his campaign, I had people coming up to me saying they hadn't come out to vote since Obama, right? And I think that is the touchstone for so many people in our community of, like, that was the last time they felt this kind of hope and this kind of energy and this sense of empowerment that they could be part of something bigger. And, you know, I think over time, many of us, the fact that folks didn't come out to vote since, right, is indicative of the fact that people have felt disempowered for a really long time. But to know that now there's a movement that's tapping back into that sentiment that we all had and saying, we're going to sustain that and we're going to make sure it doesn't fizzle out and we're going to make sure that meaningful power is built for working people across this country is what is driving so many people to come out to the polls on primaries across the country. And, you know, my mom, she's someone who really does think about politics, but because of just the conditions of my upbringing, right, wasn't something that we were constantly talking about. But it was seeing the politics play out and the fact that, you know, we were constantly having to move. We were having to make decisions about our day-to-day life that were direct results of the policy choices that our representatives are making. And my mom was very adamant about making sure that I was always getting the best education she could possibly give me. And she would go out her way to make sure that I was, like, taking the best classes, the AP classes, the IB classes. And, you know, she was like, oh, you're dropping down to a B? We'll figure out a tour. Like, that's not acceptable, you know? And for her, it was, like, very important that, like, I always felt empowered by my education. And my education just happened to bring me into thinking a lot about politics as
yeah.
well.
Yeah, yeah. And then you came to Columbia for your undergrad, my alma mater as well. And we'll talk about Columbia as an institution. I have a lot of thoughts on that.
Oh, we all do.
What was that experience like? You said you traveled to New York as a child as well. But as a resident, What was that relationship like initially? And what was your relationship with the institution itself?
Yeah, you know, I came to New York, right? I felt like in some ways I was applying to school for the sake of just being in New York because I knew that this is where I wanted to be. And growing up, like visiting family here, I just always felt like this was where I could be all parts of myself. And so I was like, I'm just going to apply to the best school I can get into New York, and we'll go from there. And I applied to Columbia. I got in, and, you know, I was very excited. I was very excited to come. And I was Afro-Latina, low-income student, you know, and I think I wasn't prepared for what that actually meant when I came in.
What do you mean?
In the sense that, you know, I was one of the best students in my high school and thought if you just like did the homework and like you'll be okay and you'll pass and all. And then I get to an institution like Columbia and everyone has, you know, been in really rigorous like classes at like private schools and they have a certain understanding of how these courses work and what kinds of courses you take. And, you know, even things like office hours, I didn't realize that you should just go to office hours. Like that was not a thing that, you know, 18-year-old me had been told that I should be doing. And so I didn't realize all of the small ways that I was being reminded, right, that I wasn't from this world. And, you know, it took adjusting to. And I think by the end of my time at Columbia, I had figured a lot of that out. Right? I was going to office hours. I was talking to my professors and built a lot of deep relationships with many of my professors that some I still talk to this day, right? But the, you know, I think there's like a lot of structural things that people don't tell you as someone who was coming from a very different world, you know, low income, like these were not things that I think I was prepared for. And then also being in a space where, you know, I would look around and the majority of my classmates didn't look like me, right? They were not from the same class background. Mm. And just number of things to navigate on the daily that you are just kind of thrown into as an 18-year-old, which is like such a young age. Like at the time you think you're old or whatever, you know, you're ready to go out on your own, but it's really such a formative and vulnerable age.
Yeah.
And to just be alone, navigating all of that, it starts to really form a lot of how you view the world.
I assume you must have built a support system around you, right? Were there any particular friends, profs who you could rely on during that time?
Yeah, I mean, I ended up organizing then. So that's how I got into organizing. It was really a building community and coming together around the things that we all cared about on campus and in the world around us. And, you know, I have a lot of deep friendships that I still have today, including with professors from that time. And I think of organizing as one of those paths to creating those types of friendships, that kind of community. Because when you come together around things that you all care about, that really drive you to get up in the morning and do something, I think that's where some of the deepest bonds are formed.
Abercrombie is here for the height of summer, with key pieces made for the days that don't slow down. The Dylan dress makes getting out the door feel easy from the start, while the Sloane tailored pant brings a more polished feel for work plans and then happy hour. And for all the moments in between or after, matching sets and everyday denim make putting together an outfit feel effortless. Keep up with the pace of summer without overthinking it. Shop Abercrombie in the app, online and in stores.
When you say organizing, break it down for me. What does it mean? Because when I think of organizing, it seems like such a difficult task. Maybe because I'm an introvert and I can sit down with one person and have a deep conversation. When I think of organizing, I think of a collective, a community. And I know you said this as well, that you are an introvert or you are a shy person. Yeah. And then I'm thinking, this shy 18-year-old was able to organize. Mm-hmm. How so?
I think of organizing in the same way I think of like organizing my room.
Ha! Interesting.
Like thinking about it as well, what is the goal? Because if the goal is to have another room entirely, like that's not going to happen, right? But if you are like, well, my goal is to organize the room, right? And just make sure everything is in its place. You can set a time span for yourself or just say little by little, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to put this here. I'm going to put that there. And when you take a step back and you're finished, you can look around and you say, oh, I accomplished that,
mm-hmm,
right? And it's like a really gratifying feeling of I put things in a way that has changed the conditions of everything around me. And I think about it in the same way for organizing people, right? Where you find people who share a vision and a goal around what it is that we want to see in the world around us. And you just build bonds there. And you start to think about, well, how do we close the gap between the world that we have and the world that we're trying to create? And if you are very clear-eyed on what that goal is, and what needs to happen to close that gap, those bonds will naturally form. Like you'll start to get to know people deeply, right? And you'll start to also see like the things that feel scary as just skill sets that you have to develop.
What did you find scary?
I think so much of it is always scary. Huh. I think that's what is so beautiful about organizing is that at a certain point you accept that the things that are worth doing are just going to be scary.
Let's talk about the things. You've mentioned them a few times. You've talked about what your goals are, what you want to achieve as the future congresswoman. What are those goals, Daria Lisa?
My district is one that has a very rich history of organizing, where so many of our giants in this country's history were doing the work. You have Ella Baker, you have Malcolm X, you have James Baldwin, people who were writers and visionaries and really thinking about what we could have as a people. And yet it is the second poorest congressional district in the state and by some measures the country. And the suffering that I see for so many of my neighbors is the direct result of an affordability crisis that is pushing so many people out of our district, where you see more and more Black and brown folks leaving the city altogether because they simply can't afford to stay there. And the tragic part of this is that these are policy choices. These are choices that our elected officials are making every single day. And when we choose to have representatives who are using our resources to invest our money, our tax dollars, in things like the war machine, in things that benefit nobody, as opposed to making sure that we are addressing this affordability crisis, right? That is all a political choice. Now that we're stepping into this role, into Congress, I'm very excited to be able to actually tackle this issue head on, making sure that we're reinvesting our resources back into our community, making sure that the working people, the Black and brown folks who make the district what it is, can stay and build their families, and that we're tackling the poverty right there, that we're tackling the childhood poverty, which is astronomical.
So let's break it down for listeners. Let's make it concrete in a way. So a woman in Washington Heights working two jobs, watching her rent go up, what does she actually get from you in your first 90 days that she wasn't getting before?
We are fighting to make sure that housing is a human right for everyone, right? And that folks can afford to stay in their homes and have dignified housing. Because that same woman in Washington Heights is probably paying way too much for that apartment. And statistically, she probably also has children. And she's probably finding it very difficult, right, to both put food on the table and pay the rent. And so if we take a two-pronged approach of tackling childhood poverty and tackling this affordability crisis on housing, we can make her life significantly easier. And so there are a number of things that we can do for each of them, but I think most concretely is making sure that we are addressing the childhood poverty epidemic that we're seeing by expanding the child tax credit and reinstating it. Because we know that it is proven to work. When we had it during the pandemic, it brought down childhood poverty rates to historic lows. So many families across the country were brought out of poverty by just having that one program. And there are a number of other programs that we can be investing into to make sure that we're bolstering those results. But just that one program would do so much for working families across New York. If we are you know, fighting for housing for all, making sure that we are actually providing people with dignified housing.
What does that mean?
So there are a number of things that we need to be doing across this district, because there, I think folks forget that there are a number of different types of housing that exists, right? And in my district, we have the most public housing units in the country. It is a district where you have, you know, the most people living within public housing in NYCHA specifically. And those folks are living in conditions that should put us all to shame, because we have not invested meaningfully in public housing in decades. And we need to fight for the funding that is going to actually reinvest and make sure that the repairs that NYCHA residents need and deserve actually happen, and making sure that we're fighting for that to be something that is not only providing the dignified housing, but is also providing jobs for people and a pathway to the middle class, which is what NYCHA was supposed to be. And when we do that, you know, we also make it so that NYCHA is no longer a last resort for people. Mm. People actually want to live there. We're making it so that market rate isn't as insane, where it doesn't cost $4,000 for a two-bedroom in Washington Heights or Harlem, in a district where no one can afford that, right?
You're basically talking about policy choices, right?
Yeah.
You're talking about, okay, how do we redistribute or pivot money to where it's needed locally from, as you said, the war machine or what's happening internationally? Because that's the policy choices that you are proposing, and a lot of DSA members do. Let's talk about DSA. Full disclosure, I don't fully understand the term itself. As far as I know, it's operating within democratically controlled political system and ensuring that people have basic economic necessities. That's it. So it's not Red Scare. It's not why the Democratic establishment is literally freaking out because their script doesn't work anymore.
Yeah.
People think, you know, constituents and voters have moved to the left. I don't think that's happened. I think they've moved to where people are listening to them. And that's you guys right now. For my listeners, can you explain what democratic socialism is and why people are so scared of it?
Yeah. So socialism is the idea that working people should get to benefit from the fruit of their labor, right? It's working people who create the wealth in the society, and we should have a say on how we use that wealth. And the way that we come to those decisions is through these democratic processes, right? We are engaging in the project of democracy. And the reason why so many are scared right now is because what we have currently is a system where corporations have an outsized influence on our democracy, right? Where they can come in the last few weeks of a race, dump millions and millions of dollars to impact the outcome of that race. And when they have folks in office, right, they can impact the votes that they make, right? And so that's why we see so many people, Republicans and Democrats alike, who take donations from these major corporations, whether that's the crypto lobby or AI or AIPAC or, you know, any number of lobbies that are right-wing corporate interests. And then they vote in ways that are reflective of those interests, right? And what so many across the country are showing right now is that they want a politic that rejects that, that is actually about empowering the working people of this country and allowing them to have a say in their own political process. And, you know, that scares folks. That scares corporate interests. That scares moneyed influence. And the fact that in races like mine, where over $7 million was being spent against me, we were still able to out-organize that, I think is what has them really scared.
And the reality is no system of governance or economic idea is absolute socialist or absolute capitalist. I don't think America was ever absolute capitalist, right? There are so many social services that people are unaware of, or they don't see it as social services, right? I do have a question around the term democratic socialism. I was talking to a colleague recently, and she was like, oh, maybe you should ask them, what if they were to change the term itself? And I was like, I will let you answer that and then I will share my thoughts on it. So have you guys ever thought of maybe democratic socialism is a trigger for a lot of people? So maybe we should use a term that's more palatable. Has that been a conversation ever?
That is what the term means, right? And I think words mean things and we should use the thing that they mean. But I also think that because so many have been, it's been ingrained in us culturally, right, to associate this in a negative light, that when you just lead what the values actually are, people are more receptive.
Right.
You know, and now we have this moment where a lot of people are taking a step back and they're saying, wait, maybe I am a democratic socialist. Because I do believe that working people should be able to benefit from the wealth that they produce in the society. I do believe that working people should be able to lead a dignified life, to make decisions about their government, and not have that taken over, right, by these corporate interests. I do believe that housing is a human right, that healthcare is a human right, that education is a human right.
I got thinking about this and I was like, look, it's the same, maybe similar to the term immigrant. Immigrant is somebody born outside the US who decides to come and live here permanently. But the word has been tabooed to the extent where my friends and colleagues who are naturalized citizens like me don't like to use immigrant for themselves anymore because they think there is so much baggage attached. But as you said, words matter. And we've made certain words negative, not because they are actually negative, but because they serve a purpose. Let's pivot a little and talk about your Muslim identity. You are a revert. I was born into this religion, so I'm again in awe of, you know, accepting it and believing in it intentionally. Outside all the attack ads and the labels, what were you looking for that you found in Islam?
You know, when I converted, I had already been fasting for Ramadan for a number of years. And I remember starting my Ramadan that year, and one of my friends was like, what are we doing? Why are you fasting again, right? When are you just going to take Shahada? What are we doing? Speed up the process. And I was like, wait, that's a great question. Like, why have I not, you know, taken this step? And I had to really sit with myself, and I used that Ramadan to really think about, like, well, what was holding me back? And I remember being at a halaqa and the imam saying, you know, Allah introduces himself to us as the most gracious and the most merciful. And whenever you are in doubt about anything, you can just come back to that. And that was, in many ways, the permission I needed, right? I think, I remember crying because I was like, well, first I didn't understand why I was crying. But then I remember thinking, so much of this world is hard. And thinking about how little grace we're given as humans, to know that my God is the most gracious and the most merciful, right, was what allowed me to really embrace Islam, right? And I think that's, for me, was what I just needed. I needed to know that there was something bigger than me that would always have grace for all of us, not just me, right? But that there would always be softness and grace and mercy through all of it. And, you know, alhamdulillah, I've found community that really, in so many ways, leads with that, right? And I think so much of my organizing is what led me to that, where I was seeing people who would look at injustices in the world and would say, that's not reflective of what I value, that's not reflective of this notion of grace and mercy that my faith and my God represents. And really thinking about, like, what does it mean to be an organizer, right? And to really have these values around humanity and, like, the equality of all humans. before something as large as God.
You know, what I really admire about your journey is how much of what you're trying to achieve is based on your lived experience, right? So you are not regurgitating somebody else's agenda or talking points. You've lived a life that has taught you certain lessons. You've traveled to places that you've advocated for. You've sat with a faith that now you're part of. What has been the steepest part of this journey, Daria Lisa? You've lived so many lives and you're still very young.
I think part of me has never really been sure of where the journey was taking me. I like to plan. I'm a planner. I like to plan. And, you know, Allah is the best of planners. I clearly am not. because, you know, I think at every turn where I was trying to plan out, okay, well, what are the next 10 years of my life, or 5 years or 10 years of my life going to look like? That has always gone out the window.
So are you telling me this was never part of the plan?
No. No. I mean, I think in the sense of like the plan in a general sense being how do I organize to build people power? Yes, that part of it. But the running for Congress part? No, I was recruited to run.
I feel in the last 2 weeks, you have said, I regret more times than a politician in their entire career. And as I said in the beginning, it may be a woman thing, it may be a minority thing, it may be a Muslim thing. There are so many layers to it in America. But what are you really regretful for? Is it the words or is it the fact that somebody took those words out of context and introduced you to the world before you had a chance to introduce yourself?
To our earlier part of the conversation, words matter, right? And I think as an organizer, when you are trying to bring people together, it matters what kinds of words we're using, right? And it matters how we're expressing our ideas in ways that are bringing folks in and that they can actually hear. And particularly when so much of what we're talking about can be very easily divisive. And if we want people to actually be able to hear what we're saying and have it land, right, it matters how we're talking to one another, right? And I think it also matters that we have accountability in our society. And in the last few weeks of my race, you know, I think what I was trying to show was not only that I believe that the words do matter and I regret my words because of that, because I do think our words should be bringing people together, not creating more divisiveness in a world that is already so divisive, but because I think that so much of our systems, they lack accountability. And what I really wanted to highlight for people is that we deserve representation that's willing to be accountable, even on what we might consider small. When you have representation that is repeatedly ignoring the needs of a community, right, and working in the interests of corporations that are actively harming that community, right, there needs to be accountability for that.
So you started with accountability with yourself first.
Mm-hmm. Because at the end of the day, these systems, they're big. And we can't change them overnight, but we can do a lot of work on ourselves because the systems are us. We are the systems. And if we can change ourselves and be accountable for ourselves and our own communities, you know, that is how we transform larger systems.
Absolutely. And I'm glad that you held yourself accountable. I feel like accountability for women or minorities seems and has always been applied so differently and so selectively. And sure, in those emotional moments, you said things that you regret, and that's fine. But I do think that as a collective, we have to recognize that some people are just held to a far stricter standard of what they say, how they conduct themselves versus others. And if you want to apply accountability, it has to be universal in every form and shape.
No, I agree. And I think, like, as much as all of these things are important to me, right? It wasn't lost on me that I was being asked to be accountable to tweets that were written when I was a 20-something that held no political power.
Right.
Like, that wasn't lost on me.
Right.
While I was trying to hold someone accountable for their political choices while holding political power.
Right. There is this idea of perfect victim, perfect villain, perfect human, and perfection does not exist within humans. We are messy and we make mistakes as long as you said, we are intentional, which you were. Lisa, you beat the machine. Now you have to join a version of it that's bureaucratic, that's slow. How do you stay true to yourself?
You know, I see this as just another step in this process, right? In this vision that we're building towards. And I think making sure that you're surrounding yourself with the very people who trusted you with the role to begin with is how you stay grounded, right? And reminding yourself, like, why you're doing this.
Let me ask you this. Is there any part of you that's scared that something may change? Like, are you trying to preserve a part of you that you are scared might change?
When I was recruited to run, I needed to think about it, right? Because this was a life-changing decision. And I remember in the few weeks leading up to when I said yes, I woke up in the middle of the night in like a panic. And I was like, oh my God, what if I become a moderate? And I was like freaking out. Like, it was like a legit panic attack.
Oh my gosh, I love it.
Because I was worried that I would lose myself, right? I think at the heart of it was I was worried that I would lose sight of who I was, what my values were. And then I remembered, well, first of all, I'm a sociologist. Like, that's what I've been trained in, right? And I know that our social systems, they can all be transformed if we are willing to organize people to transform them. And it takes time, but, you know, social systems are just the product of people coming together.
Right.
Right? And we can bring people together in a way that transforms them. And when I remembered that, that was when I was able to be like, oh, we'll be okay. And knowing that all that is, and I say all that is required as though it's not a big thing, but, you know, I think when we break it down into something a little more tangible of what's required of us in this moment is remembering that fact and surrounding ourselves with people who share a similar vision, right? And making sure that we're coming back to one another repeatedly.
And not that it's your responsibility and you should not be the one bearing this burden, but I will still ask you this. For the moderates or Republicans who are losing their shit right now, what do you say to them?
You know, I don't really have much to say right now because I think what they're doing right now is they're engaging in distraction, right? Distraction from what we set out to do, which was to make sure that we're delivering housing for all in our district, to make sure that we're eradicating childhood poverty, to make sure that our tax dollars stop going towards a war machine and start coming back to our communities to invest in our schools and our kids, in our just all of our public institutions, right? Making sure that we're protecting our immigrant neighbors, that we're abolishing ICE and creating pathways to citizenship. Those are the things that people elected me to do. And I just don't have any interest, right, in listening to the complaints and the worries and the pearl clutching of Republicans and folks in the center who are more concerned about corporate interests. That is not why the people of New York 13 elected
me. And they elected you. That says a lot. In the end, if you were to define the United States of America in a word or a sentence, how would you do that?
It is a country full of people who have had a beautiful vision of what it means to come together in the face of so much horror and be resilient against it.
Yeah, I love it. Thank you, Daria Lisa. It's an honor to sit down with you and have this conversation, and best of luck for the future.
Thank you.
To be honest, this conversation could have gone on for another hour uninterrupted. I had so many more questions around ICE, around prisons, and what I think people are missing when they think of Daria Lisa, how some moderates or democratic establishment approaches her success, is the fact that every decision, every policy stance that she is talking about is in the context of what she's seen in courtrooms, what she's experienced herself. And that should account for a lot of what she believes in. And it was such a pleasure to sit down with her beyond the policy realm, beyond discussing DSA, what it stands for, what she envisions for the future of this country, to see this young 32-year-old being thrown into the limelight and really navigating that space with dignity. And you know what? Once we stopped recording, something that we all agreed on was, and listen to this closely, dissent is patriotic. When we call out unjust systems and structures in this country, we do because we believe in the goodness that this country embodies and the promise that this country holds. Because you know what? When you are invested in something, when you truly believe in something, that's when you try to make it better. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, share it with a friend, a skeptic, maybe a moderate Democrat, and give it a 5-star review on Apple, guys. That's how people discover us. That's how they find out about Immigrantly. And if you want to follow me on Instagram, you can do that at It's Sadia K. This episode was written and produced by me, Sadia Khan. The editorial review is done by Shea Yu. Our sound designer and editor is Lou Raskin. Immigrantly's theme music is by Simon Hutchinson. Other music by Epidemic Sound. Come back for another important conversation. Until then, take care and be nice to others.